Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, September 12th, 2023. Always so good to be back in the studio, Heritage Radio Network studio at Roberta's Pizza, Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So big shout out to Roberta's Pizza. Thanks so much for supporting us all these years. Going on 15 years of Heritage Radio Network, and it's our 14th season of Beer Sessions Radio. So we're in the studio here at Roberta's Pizza, and we're going to be talking a little bit about rice and sake and koji and things like that. I'll just have our guests introduce themselves because it's really their show and they're going to talk about.
All right, I'm Shinobu Kato from Kato Sake Works, and I'm a sake brewer.
And I'm Pete Langell Fushimi, and I'm not a sake brewer, beer brewer, currently at Rockaway Brewing in Long Island City.
So we've had these guys on before a few times over the years, and it's always my pleasure to dive deeper into fermentation and the inner workings of what makes what's in our glass so good. But let's start with Shinobu. So a few years ago, it was like 2019. We went when you were just opening your first little sake brewery, and we got to drink some sakes, and we've had you on since then. But a lot of things have changed. You've expanded and opened a bigger place, just in the same neighborhood, but a little further away in Troutman. So let's talk about those steps. Like, you had your brewery, it was COVID, and now you're bigger.
Sure. So I think the time that you came to our original location was right before our soft opening. I think we had our counters barely set up with our, you know, plywood or something like that. And then we went ahead and then opened, and then COVID happened, as you mentioned. So we were there for 3 years, never opened as a tap room, but just brewing and bottling. But thanks to the local neighborhood and then, you know, like communities like Roberta's, we got enough sales to survive throughout those years. And at some point, we reached to the capacity, because you've seen how small that space was, you know, like 400 square feet, like a studio apartment size.
It was like a cute little cafe.
Yes, yes. Actually, there is a cafe right now next door. So, yeah. So that's around time that we started thinking that, hey, we may need to have a bigger space. And construction and then everything, of course, took like over a year. But now we have a new space on Troutman, a little bit bigger than what we had, and we have a functioning tap room. So
that's great. So in those steps, like, you know, we've talked a lot about with brewers and brewery owners about what they go through when they're building a brewery and the equipment they're getting. You know, where did you source your equipment from? Most sake? Is it a sake brewery? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, we call it sake brewery. Is because beer is probably the closest cousin. But we get most of the equipment from the beer equipment companies. It's too expensive or not realistic to get everything from Japan, right? So we get most like stainless steel shiny stuff from the West Coast, and then everything else we either DIY'd or try to repurpose something else. Yeah, I still remember that when I was sourcing a new bigger tank, Pete and then I had a kind of quick text, and then I told Pete that I'm so scared to buy this big stuff, And Pete told me that, hey, but it's probably more scary if you don't buy a Goodman. So that was a good, like, a, you know, mentorship I got.
Yeah, that's a good intro, Pete. So what equipment was he talking about? Do you remember?
I remember a third location. I went to the very first kind of proof of concept location. So I've seen him grow like three times now. So that was probably the new equipment you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, in beer and in probably socket production, anything, you're producing a product, if you don't have the right capacity and if you don't have the right correctly sized equipment, then you're going to get stuck. You're going to just be like treading water where you're just not actually bringing in enough revenue to grow or to even barely stay alive. And if you have undersized equipment and you have the sales, then you're just spending a ton on payroll. You got so much manpower or woman power to produce your product, all your money is going to payroll. So, you know, we always have to keep in mind it's a business too. And the equipment is a big, something that you really have to consider. It's a big factor in the success of your business, properly sized equipment for your goals. You also have to, you need a business plan. You need a plan. Like, this is how much we're going to produce. This is the split for tap room and distro and export or this or that. And like, so equipment makes your life a lot easier, especially coming from home brewing to professional brewing. I remember I was like terrified to produce beer on a professional system. And I know so many brewers are trying to tiptoe into it and like get the right equipment. Actual professional brewing equipment makes it so much easier to produce beer and get it at the right size. It takes the same, basically the same amount of effort to produce 50 barrels as it does to make 5 barrels of beer. And if you're making 50 barrels on a 5-barrel kit, that's 10 times as much effort and payroll.
Maybe cute.
My 2 cents.
Because you're tired too.
Yeah.
And Shinova, so yeah. You started out, what was that first proof of concept? Was it in your home or did you actually have a store?
Yeah, that time I had a different partnership. And then, yes, actually we came here when Steve Hindy was here.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That was the first time. But at the time, I was working on a proof of concept near the Barclays Center. But it's not open. And then, you know, doors shut down. The window is splayed so that nobody knows that we are making sake there.
Is that a siren I hear?
Oh, yeah. And then, so with the jump to the new one. So Troutman, I mean, it's a cool area. And then you can take, the L train for the Jefferson stops. So always convenient. But what I'm trying to get out of you. What equipment did you have to buy? This is what I want to hear. Like, you're buying a brew kettle. What do you need for Koji? We might as well go through the steps of making sake since you guys are both pretty knowledgeable.
Sure. So assuming that everybody listening to this radio knows beer brewing process very well. So our process is very similar. We do not have a hot side. We just do a kind of dry steaming and then everything else is a cold side. The big difference is koji making. While koji making for us is more like a malt house, in-house malt house for beer industry. So we have like small malt house to grow ingredients for ourselves. But that koji making is very similar to like a malt making, a little bit shorter, but high temperature humidity, you know, instead of sprouting barley for beer, we are growing mold on rice, but process is very similar. And we use koji rice in the same way that beer brewer use mold in your system. So when you come in, but basically, you are seeing like very similar to beer brewery.
Yeah, we brewers often say that most of the brewing is actually done in the malt house because we're purchasing malt. Most breweries these days, historically, they would make their own malt, but most breweries, and some still are making their own malt, but most just purchasing malt from maltsters. And there, you know, you take raw barley or other cereal grains, and you're basically germinating the seed. It's a seed, a kernel. And you're letting it grow. It's producing enzymes that we're going to be using later on. Amylase enzymes are the key players here. And then they're stopping it. They're fixing it. They're dehydrating it. And then they're preserving the enzymes. This is base malt. And then they're, for certain other malts for flavor and color, they're kilning or even drum roasting to get all those colors and flavors. So we're in barley and beer production, we're using two amylase enzymes that are produced in the malt house that are convert starch into sugars. So in sake brewing, they're using a mold, the super mold, koji, that produces proteases and amylases, and it produces, it converts the starch from rice into fermentable
sugars. How do you get the koji? Do you order it?
So we get the spores of the seed of koji mold from Japan. And then we sprinkle spores on steamed rice and then grow it for 48 hours. So the room is like your bathroom, humid and then warm. And we just grow mold. And then at the end, we have a fluffy molded rice, like a white blue cheese type of texture. Yeah, and then that has all the enzymes that just Pete explained that you need to convert starch in the rice into the sugar.
Sounds like you could do like a dual business where you have like a sauna and then you have a koji. Sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it sure does. But
comfy.
You got that extra heat going on too, right?
Yeah.
And what kind of rice do you use?
We use the rice from named Cal Rose. It's a variety from California. It's a medium grain rice, a hybrid of Japanese native short grain rice to American native long grain rice. And then chances are that when you go to a sushi restaurant, probably that's the same type of rice.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Is it a white rice? It's not Uncle Ben's.
No.
Is it a white rice or a brown rice?
It's a white rice. And actually, that's a good point that one of the big thing in sake making is a rice polishing or rice milling. So brown rice is not milled at all. So it's, husks take away, but it's like 100% intact. And white rice is 90%, meaning 10% of the brownish portion, outer layer, is milled away. Our sake rice is 60%. So 40% of the outside is polished away because outside has a concentration of protein, ash, fat, those type of things that if fermented can be a source of flavor, while center is just a pure starch.
Wow. It's pretty cool.
That's what I wanted to get into if we have time. Like, how do you make different styles? How do you differentiate your sake? For beer, we have a whole palette of malts. We have a whole palette of hops. We have yeast is a big player in the flavor of beer. We have lots of knobs and levers we can pull for different beers. But for sake, it seems so much simpler. It's like rice and koji. But is there water chemistry that comes into it? Like, we do water chemistry is huge for beer. Are there different yeast strains, different koji strains, rice polishes?
Yeah, there are some, dials that we can play with ingredients, but not, it's more subtle compared to the wide range of the beer styles, I think. Because if you go to sake bar, even though you try all the different type of sake, at the end, it's kind of tastes like sake, right?
Except for hangover sake, as my wife calls it.
Is that because... you mean there's not like a really wide range of sake flavors?
Maybe just culturally and historically, I guess. Like, Japan is a very homogeneous society with the same type of food. While, Europe and then US, you eat a lot of different stuff and, Your culinary culture is much more wider. So maybe the drink kind of follows the same path, I guess. That's my guess.
So sake tastes like sake?
Yeah.
That's easy.
I'm just getting into it, I do always check the region, where it's from, the prefecture in Japan. And I have found that I like certain prefectures better than others. But and then there's what we're drinking right now is a Nigori, so that's cloudy. So that's one difference. And maybe you could explain the difference between Nigori and Junmai and all those other,
descriptors. I got about 15 years ago from an importer. I did get a pretty good primer on the styles and the regions, but we're also talking about New York's sake.
Yeah. So, there are a couple of different styles, lager style, IPA type, so that some sake is not filtered, some sake is not pasteurized, the pressing method is a little bit different, but still, it's not as dynamic as beer varieties, I guess. Oh, we talking about the water, yes, New York water is really good, much softer than, you know, U.S. average, and then that works well for our fermentation. Or it's probably softer than Japanese average as well, or and then it gives you much kind of slower, mellower fermentation for our sake. If you have more kind of harder water, you have more kind of, you know, vigorous fermentation with drier, stronger sake.
Do you adjust the temperature as well?
We
What's the fermentation temperature?
Our temperature is 10 C, so that's like 50 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so it's lager temp.
Yeah, it's quite
a little
low.
High for lager.
Yeah. Oh.
Wow. Hey, Shinobu, we're actually drinking your sake. Why don't you tell us about this one? And, you know, again, like, I know you have some of your own labels, like this Tokubetsu number 7.
Yeah.
You know, how do we decipher your, is this like transmitter where there's letters and numbers? And
Yeah. So we just do a very simple English-Japanese translation. So we are not making like fancy names or like, you know, Koji Kid or anything. But it's Nigori means, literally means cloudy. So it's a cloudy sake. And Tokubetsu literally means special. So this is a special batch number 7. Yeah, so our naming convention is very simple. And then this is intentional because, you know, most of the people are still new to sake. And when you go to a restaurant, if you remember the name Nigori, at least that kind of helps you to pinpoint what you want to order, right? So we kind of want to help our customers to start building a basic vocabulary of sake.
I think that's all part of the appeal, you know, to even craft beer and wine and sake and everything, like learning. It's
definitely it's tasting. Always, and what's junmai?
Junmai means pure rice. And I'm going into a little bit technical, but some of the sake in Japan, you are allowed to add distilled alcohol. Yeah. So it's like a fortified sake. While junmai means all the fermentation is from the rice.
Wait a minute. I can get sake from Japan that isn't all from rice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I never knew that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Warning, people. So we should only be drinking New York made pure rice sakis, right?
Well, yeah, that's for sure. But some of the sake
I learned something on every damn show, Armin. You know that?
Yeah,
and it's that, usually what I'm supposed to avoid.
Well, it's not necessarily bad, although some bad sake is made with added alcohol too. But that's not necessarily bad either.
But can be. That's the
can be.
That's the hangover sake. My wife.
That's hangover sake.
The cheap stuff.
Yeah, but. You know, we spend a lot of time with a cold fermentation to keep the flavor in sake. And that's a volatile or, you know, esters. If you add a little bit of the high alcohol at the very end of the fermentation, that helps you to retain the flavor in the final product. And that's a part of the techniques that some people use additional alcohol.
Alcohol is a solvent.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We use temperature for many things, ester production, you know, aromatics, but also there's fusel alcohols. So high temperature fermentation with a sake yeast or something is going to produce these. Those are the hangover alcohols. Those are the ones you don't want. Those are the impurities. So I guess your range is also attemperating the fusel production, ester production, just like beer.
Yeah.
It's beer. It's definitely beer. You told me a story that you had to get a wine license in New York State.
Yeah.
Because someone from the SLA was at dinner and asked the server, like, is sake beer or wine? And the server told him, it's wine.
Yeah.
So he's, and like, wine is fruit.
Yeah.
It's fruit. It's not starch. It's fruit sugars, you know, grapes. And I guess there's a whole broad category of wine, but rice is a cereal grain, just like barley and wheat and all the grains that we use in beer. It's beer.
So it should be beer. So how many licensed sake makers are there in New York? Just two?
Two. And
you know, Kura and you, Cotton
Yes,
Kato.
And becoming three, or maybe has become three because there's a Dasai
in
Hyde Park upstate. and they are bringing a big facility. So Dasai is like a recognized worldwide brand, quite famous that you get at any high-end restaurants, but they are opening a local facility in New York.
Oh, wow.
This month. Yeah.
So, Pete, you
supposed to be this month.
That was a good this point. Month. Yeah. So even when you think about the licensing, if you're classified as wine versus beer, it can depend on where you can sell it and buy it. So you are a New York State wine license?
Yes. Wine so we do have a beer brewery license from federal government, TTB. We have a winery sales license from TTB, and then winery production license from New York State.
Yeah. So where can you sell? Can you sell in a wine store?
Yeah.
Can you sell in a grocery store?
Beer? Yeah, that's a big one.
I don't know. I don't think so. But
and you can, but you, then you can sell to restaurants that have a wine license or a liquor license.
Yeah. So usually we don't have any problem selling to the typical customer base that we have.
You might have a different excise tax rate, though.
Yes.
Maybe it's to your benefit.
To my benefit.
Good.
And also we can do a direct-to-consumer shipping without having a COVID exception.
I will say one thing about New York, which I love, is that it seems like all other craft alcohol licenses have really been reformed in the last 10 years and are pretty good. You know, I don't think you're going to be up against too many problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything else you want to say about that? Because we're always big fans of New York State Liquor Authority.
No, really, you know, this transition from the old space to the new place was a little bit...
Difficult.
Yeah, difficult.
Muzogashi.
Yeah.
But
to transfer the license.
And when did you open? Because I've just been waiting and waiting and waiting. And I've asked you, I think every 2 months, Pete, I've asked... to come on the show, and he's like, "I'm too busy. I'm too busy. I'm too busy." And he also didn't want to tell anyone about it before it was open.
So April 22nd was when we opened the door, because that was when the Troutman Open Street first day. So Troutman Street, they blocked the two blocks, and on the weekend it's no traffic. So it was a big deal, and we were like, "Okay, we need to open by then." So we opened on that day, but we didn't have a liquor license. Mm. So we only sold T-shirts. We got the license mailed to our location on Monday with a timestamp on the Thursday.
So you could have sold.
So we could have sold thing. But
snail mail.
Yeah. And then around that time, we didn't have enough production yet. So we were still, you know, producing at the old space. So we didn't have enough sake. We only have like one sake on tap, and then most of the bottles are sold out. So we didn't do like a big opening ceremony or something like that. And then now we are here, so.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, and you're planning an opening party with a surprise.
Yes.
So will you
tell
us?
A parade?
If you tell us a surprise, actually by the time this is September, what is today, 12th? This probably won't be on the air for a couple weeks, so you can tell me the surprise. How about that?
So grand opening will be on October 1st. Yeah, October 1st is a Wild Sake Day.
Oh,
somebody decided that October 1st is a Sake Day. So we will celebrate the Wild Sake Day as a grand opening. We will have...
That's like World Naked Gardening Day.
Yeah, it's probably five different
sake,
days.
Yeah. Drink sake.
They ran out of days. There's only 365. They got to double them up.
I love that World Sake Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll have... We will have live music.
Sumo wrestling?
Not sumo wrestling.
Please.
We
know some
sumo.
People that are trying to do sumo and ramen in one store, so...
Ramen's good, too.
Yeah. But Shinobu, I am so happy for you.
Thank you.
I mean, it was 4 years ago, fall of 2019. You came on before your opening. You actually were here for our 500th episode. We went to your little shop then and drank some really good sake. And the thing about drinking sake, the myth of sake is that, for me, of course, you know, I came of age in the, whatever, 80s or 90s in New York, and then going to a typical Japanese restaurant was the thing to do. It was the date night. And getting hot sake was really cool. But we didn't really know anything about sake. And then it was about 15 or 16 years ago at my old spot, Jimmy's number 43, back when I only had a beer and wine license, I thought I'll diversify my drinks menu because I don't have like hard alcohol. And I went for sake, and I met some of the great importers. The sake sold out so quickly, I didn't even realize it was gone. And what I'm trying to say about the sake category is that when you only have a wine and beer license, it's a great way to diversify. So you can have beer, some wine and cider, but you can have sake. But the minute I got my full alcohol license, forget it. Sake just disappeared, and vodka was the king. Hmm. So I'm a fan of these for you guys opening places at restaurant and restaurant wine licenses is beer and wine, including cider in New York State. It's a great license for a restaurant. It's a really great way if you care about your food and the products on your list. But you can also serve sake on that. So with a restaurant wine license, this is my little lesson to you, new operators. You can serve wine, beer, sake, and cider. And just those four categories alone, you will never touch the surface of just how good your drinks menu can be. And then I've actually found, I'm not anti-alcohol, and I love New York State spirits, but the minute you get full alcohol on, the person that walks in saying, I want a vodka soda, when you don't have a full alcohol license, your staff has to say, well, you know what? We've got these really interesting beers. Why don't you taste these? Or we have cider as well. Or we have sake as well, something that's a little different. But the minute you have full alcohol, the person comes in asking for a vodka soda or what the vodka cocktail is or any other cocktail, suddenly you're giving up your entire beer program or sake program or cider program. And it's a different way of thinking of things. But I had places in New York for 25 years, but each time that I got the full, I went from restaurant wine license to a full liquor license, I have to say that the core of my business actually didn't get better, you know. And it became an easy sell for the staff to give that person a vodka soda. It's only an example, but I'm trying to say the sake, if you have a restaurant wine license, which is easy to get, and you have some food, go ahead, get some sake.
Buy more sake.
Am I being radical? Is that crazy that I said that?
That makes sense.
Not to me.
Yeah, yeah.
My introduction to sake was probably at a Japanese restaurant, and it might have been not the best quality sake, I think, in this country back in the day, because I'm not young. I think a lot of the sake that you would get at these, you know, not high-end Japanese restaurants was what my wife calls hangover sake, and it's probably fortified with really cheap,
you know. You're married to a Japanese person.
Yeah, yes. Alcohol. And
you've been to Japan.
Yeah, and so I thought, I didn't like sake forever. I wanted to like it. And then when I finally had some good sake, it just, you know, blew my hair back. I was like, whoa, this is, I love it now.
Think about sake, and I'm going to finish my rant, but it has to be good. There's the like I said, with all the options available for drinks, if you're going to pick sake, that's why I keep using this example of a vodka soda. That's kind of like when you go, and unfortunately, guys, wake up, because there's a lot of bars and restaurants where there's not really a lot of good choices for the beer or other things. So a vodka soda or a vodka tonic or a tequila and soda tonic is a safe bet, because you're going to get something that you know. But when you're talking sake, if you're going to offer sake and you're in New York City in particular, there's a range of not only really good importers, there's producers like Shinobu at Kato Sake Works, where you can get a well-made product, locally made, that probably is better for you too, right? You guys can't talk about the health benefits of alcohol, but you know what? It always keeps coming up. I have doctor friends of mine have said, you know, when you run a race, you're gonna drink Gatorade because it restores electrolytes. But actually,
beer.
The original message was that beer was the model for restoring electrolytes. So let's talk about how good your sake can be for us in our world. Because what's the alcohol content of the sake that we're drinking?
16%.
Yeah, that's something I want to ask you. What's the range of alcohol, especially with these fortified ones? Like, where does it go?
The fortified ones still around 16% because they add more alcohol, they water back.
Less expensive rice and more grain alcohol.
But we're talking about yours. You're fine,
yours.
Locally made.
Yeah, so this one's
16%. And then how else can we, like, what are adjectives we can use? Are you an artisanal? You a small craft. Batch craft? Craft still matters. You are a craft sake maker?
I think so. Yeah. Right.
What do you think?
How would you describe? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. By definition. But how do you describe your business?
Like a small sake,
just a small sake.
Local brewery, like local.
Maybe that's the norm in Japan. There's a whole range. There's big ones and small ones.
Yeah, yeah. But I think in Japan, sake brewery is more like a beer brewery here, so that there's a lot of local
small
ones loved by the neighborhood, but you don't know them unless you go there.
Yeah.
You know, you can get the distribution in like a few states maybe, but I think it used to be like that in Japan. Nowadays, maybe you can access to any sake if you go to Tokyo.
So is that your experience? Is that when you wanted to make sake in New York, you were thinking of these having local small sake brewery like you used to have in Japan?
Yeah, because I love go to local breweries and wineries. That's a fun thing to explore the neighborhood. And I did the same thing back in Japan. You know, every time I travel, I find the local sake breweries and then, you know, have some fun. Oh, sake is still like mystified or like intimidated by people here, you know, just because it's so far away, you know.
Yeah, and it's like, how do you serve it? Do you have to have the waterfall?
In a
fancy Japanese, mm-hmm. You have to have the waterfall and the square wooden cup, or do you have hot sake or cold?
Yeah, how do you determine if it needs to be hot or cold? Are yours all cold or some hot?
My usual answer is it's a personal preference.
Try it.
So don't get dictated by your sommelier or whoever who tells you whatever they want to say. But today's hot, so I want to have my sake cold.
Do you actually serve your sakes hot?
Yeah.
And the tapper?
We haven't tried yet. But
for yourself, your preference,
mm-hmm.
when and which sakes would you serve warm and how would you warm it? That's the other question. You're not pouring hot water in it. Like
water
a
bath?
Water bath is a proper way. Not the right way. Not the right answer, but it's easy answer is microwave. It works. It works.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah. Why? Because you have a stomach ache and you want some warm sake?
Warm sake helps because, you know, in a kind of Eastern medicine, the body temperature and the, you know, drink temperature and those kind of thing. But also, it does not give your, you know, temperature differences that good. And then, you know, New York winter is so cold. It's nice to have a cup of warm sake in your hand, right?
The old, like, what people would say about, you know, again, talking about this, my introduction to sake is like, cheap sake is hot because it's really bad if it's cold. But that's not the case. Like, I went to a dinner, and Shinomo was in the one after us, and it's called Okan, right? Maybe mm-hmm. you can explain. I have the sticker on my phone from this dinner, and mm-hmm. there was this guy who does, he's a chef from Japan. He came and he does this whole multi-course dinner, and he pairs it with hot sake. And they're at different temperatures. He has different, like, ceramic, tin, different glass, different vessels that he's heating the sake in and different ways of heating it. It's like, it gets very complicated. But,
wait, what's it called? What?
I'm going to let Shinobu explain this.
How do you spell it?
Yeah. O-K-A-N. But K-A-N is a verb to warm up sake.
Ah.
Yeah, so okan is a kind of polite way to say that.
So this would be more exciting for people than just trying to have a cannabis dinner. I could have an okan mm-hmm. sake dinner. That's what I want, man.
It was awesome.
I want to hear about the stories of you guys going deep with your boutique, craft, whatever we call it anymore, specialty beverages and food, because that's what this whole life's about, man, right?
Yeah. Have you done any like sake and you know, food tastings or dinners anywhere or anything like that?
We haven't done that yet, but we'd love to. And if we are doing, we want to do a little bit, you know.
Pete, do you cook too?
I do. Yeah.
I know you're very detail oriented, and so what? Let's go back to this one. Let's do some pairings because pairings is a new frontier for every beverage. That's good. So this is a Nigori sake made in Bushwick. All right. If you were going to construct a little menu or a dish, probably a simple dish, what would you make? Yours at home, enjoying this Nigori. It's probably almost quarter of six.
I would just play it safe. I'd play it safe and go with some, you know, Japanese fare. Like,
would you make some eggs and vegetables? Or?
No, maybe like a, I don't know. What do you think? An udon? A noodle?
In
summertime, like a cold udon plate or something.
Yeah. Also, you know, because
I'm going to bump this one over.
You grilled smash burger when I visited you back the other day.
Yeah.
So I think that goes with burger.
Okay.
Pete wants American food.
Yeah.
Pete wants Japanese food.
Yeah. No, I'm a notorious burger fiend. So and thin patty. I'm a thin patty guy, FYI. And yeah, sake goes with lots of things. Right?
Yeah.
I wasn't gonna say that, but on the air.
I definitely think this one is a smash burger.
I think and this beer, this sake, I said beer, is delicious. It just drinks itself. It's dangerous. Yeah. Slippery.
Well, salute to that. So, Shinobu, before we take a break, because we're going to take a short break, do you have ambitions? Like, what are the ambitions for the new Kato Sake facility on Troutman Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn? Will there be food? Will there be pop-ups?
We'll have pop-ups. We'll have
Will there
music.
Be okonomiyaki?
No.
None of the...
You know, food
crazy
is somebody else's
food.
Specialties. You know, we are good at... Maybe a little bit good at making sake, but nothing else. So that's... You know, we ask for somebody else to take care.
Yeah. What if I wanted to come one day and Pete and I would cook some rice with...
You're there and you'll have like... You
like
know.
Seven mushroom rice.
Yeah, you'll have an endless flow of sake. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's on the air. You've all heard it.
I can do it, man.
We're going to show up.
But you
endless
have to...
flow.
I do cook every day.
You have to feed all our staff.
It's easy for me.
That's nothing.
You know.
And some of our staff are like gluten-free and vegan. So.
Oh.
Well, then you tell me the base.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this. Ooh, shout out about that. Whether you're drinking sake or you're vegan-free. My first restaurant in the 1990s. It's time for me to talk about it myself, right?
I had this bottle.
Because sake makes me happy. And a good craft, locally made beverage is my favorite thing in the world. Then my first restaurant, I opened it up. I didn't really know what I was doing. But I did know about food. And I know how to make a little bit of food. And I had some customers that said they were vegan. And I went to my Italian, you know, pantry. And I was like, great, I have a corn polenta. You know, and over time I got polenta that was grown. The corn was grown and milled upstate. And simple things and vegetables. And it's like, I can cook this way. In fact, I grew up this way. People used to say peasant food. That was cool. But it is, but it's not even peasant food. It's luxury food. If you're getting fresh vegetables,
other things, nuts.
And the older people get, it's like, you know what, I can have a simple menu of nuts and other things that provide protein. I don't need a processed vegan meat. I'm really ranting today, but you know what it is? It's being with you guys and the joy of being back at the Heritage Radio Network studio at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. So we're going to take a short break, and my buddy Armin is the engineer now. So big thanks to everybody. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Woo!
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni. This is our 14th season of Beer Sessions Radio, probably the 15th year of Heritage Radio Network here at the studio at Roberta's in Bushwick. And I just want to say, support us, become a member, heritageradionetwork.org/donate. There's a lot of great things happening out of this space and on online, heritageradionetwork.org. So we're talking about sake. Back in 2019, our friend Shinobu Kato of Kato Sake Works opened nearby in Bushwick his first small sake facility. And we went there on our 500th episode way back in fall of 2019. Well, here he's back with us now in 2023. He's recently opened a newer, bigger facility on Troutman Street in Bushwick. So Shinobu, welcome back, and our good friend Pete Lengo, a great New York City brewer who's been very aware of science fermenting and things from the beginning, and we're really happy to have you back as well, Pete. So thanks.
glad to be here.
We were drinking sake. We went through this wonderful bottle of the Nigori sake. We talked a little bit about sake. I think we can still talk more about sake and food pairings and everything, because the hardest part of everything that you do when you have a restaurant, when you're making a meal at home, is really finding quality ingredients and quality beverages, you know. And I think number one for this show has been about, you know, we're going to talk about quality products without being expensive. You know, we don't have to be the most, we don't have to talk about caviar. We don't have to talk about champagne. There's so many things that are locally made that I've recently found in the last few years that there's small farms that happen to grow beets and onions, and incorporating just a simple locally grown in the Northeast, a beet and an onion into my diet makes me not even want to get a beet or an onion from a supermarket anymore, because it's about the process. Why should something be made that is going to be meant to be kept in cold storage for a long time and sit on a supermarket shelf, you know? And I'm not like a proselytizer or anything, but I actually, in my daily life, I should let my listeners know, I care about what I eat and drink. And the number one thing, as Pete was saying before, is that there's the bad hangover drink, and there's the okay fuzzy hangover. And I learned that years ago. It's like, if it's well made from quality ingredients, and usually small, I think small batch does matter, because you have to pay attention to the details then. This is what I'm talking about. Why is a small batch product less likely to give me a headache or a bad hangover than a large mass-produced product?
Well, it's about quality and execution. Not just ingredients, but it's execution, you know, like he was talking, like Shinobu was talking about with the fortified sakes. If it's a really low price point mass-produced thing, they might be using some pretty crappy, you know, alcohol to put in there. That's got a lot of.
I can't believe that. Yeah. So some Japanese sakes have adulterated their product with.
Yeah, we call it adulterated, which sounds bad, and sometimes it is bad. But maybe you can drink more
because it's cheaper.
There's a whole range, you know, but it doesn't mean just because it's fortified that it's bad, but it can be.
And it also damages your image. If you think that sake is cheap, it's going to be heated because it doesn't taste good. You know, maybe that sake does have adulterated alcohol in it, you know?
Maybe they heat it so they can volatilize off some of those like nasty, you know, higher alcohols. But
we're not talking about being at Shinobu's house and having him gently heat in a microwave.
gently microwaving it. No, that dinner that we went to, that, you know, Shinobu was at too, like it was
Okan?
Yeah, Okan. So next time I'm gonna invite you.
Very cool.
If I get invited myself. But I told you he had different types of materials because of the heat transfer coefficient, and he did it in different ways. He did water bath and he did a flame one. He did you know, you can go down a rabbit hole on that stuff.
You know, Pete, many of our listeners, and going back for years, they'd be like, if they're in New York or they're not in New York, when they come to New York, they want to go to these insider things. So now definitely everyone coming to New York, you got to check out Kata Sake Works on Trauma Treat. But for Pete, how do you find out about the Okan, these specialty sake dinners?
Yeah.
Because I want to go to those.
How did you find out about that? So
I don't even remember.
Was it through, we have a mutual friend, Yuki, who works for...
Do you have to be Japanese?
Maybe. I'm not, but my wife is. But we have a mutual friend who works for a restaurateur from Japan. He has 5 restaurants here, and he brought these guys in from Japan, and he did it at one of his restaurants. It's, you know, pretty... It's just for like a weekend.
So yeah.
Pretty exclusive sounds kind of snobby, but it was just a small thing, but it was amazing. It was like, I'll never forget it. It was a great meal, and the people were awesome.
That chef has a restaurant in Tokyo, so if you go to Tokyo,
you can do it
in
Tokyo.
That.
Yeah.
So but, what's different about like the way people drink and eat in Japan than here? Like, I remember I have some friends who were in New York. They're from Japan. There's something in some of the Japanese pubs. It's like a salted... soy salted fish. So these types of snacks that would be at a
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
What is that called?
What's it called?
Niboshi, maybe?
Yeah, like a small fish with a, like a small dried fish that
heavily
you can
salted. And they gave heavily me a salted whole selection. Instead of peanuts.
Yeah,
but I ate so much of it that my stomach dried up.
Dry.
You dehydrated your stomach.
Yeah, but instead of having peanuts, I had these salted, soy salted fish that were brilliant.
And did you make you drink a lot of sake?
I think it was beer in that time, yes, but I would.
But in Japan, people drink sake in the same way that you drink beer and wine here.
Yeah,
so,
I did.
Right? Yeah. So there's no like any special elevated status for sake. Sake is just a drink.
It's the local.
Just a local drink. And it's casual. Of course, you know, everybody had the experience with bad hangover sake when they
Just like beer. There's hangover beer too.
Right. And then eventually you go to craft small batch.
Sure, but why is that different? I mean, it's obvious to us now, but when you're younger, because I think about younger people, which is the future of our industry, I start out, I drink a lot, and I get a bad hangover. Mm. One day I try something, doesn't give me a bad hangover. What's the difference? And do you think about that when you make your sake? Because it's not health. I can't say that any alcohol is healthy, but a better made product can actually be healthy.
Yeah, I never worked in a large commercial facility, but there's a lot of way to make more money. Not cutting corners, but like cutting corners and doing things that's probably a little bit different from eating good food and a good drink kind of thing. But still, you know, that's okay. I think those are the things that make you hangover, I guess.
Yeah.
Like fermentation temperature.
Like
for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. So fermentation in a brewery and sake brewery, anywhere that you're producing, your fermentation tanks, the vessels that you're fermenting in, that's the usual bottleneck. And fermentation time is going to tie up those tanks. That's why most craft breweries are doing ales historically, because they're done in 2 to 3 weeks. And lagers should take at least 6 weeks. So it ties up your fermentation. So it's really limiting your ability to produce and your revenue doing lagers versus ales. So that's why craft...
So the guy's taking... Really doing it right with lagers that took months and months, they go out of business.
Well, if they planned it right, like we were talking about in the beginning of this, like if they have the right equipment and the right, you know, size equipment and the quantity, they're fine. But Jack's Abbey comes to mind. But so one way to kind of alleviate that stress on your production is to raise the fermentation temperature so things will go faster. It's a chemical reaction. It's not exactly, but when you increase the temperature in any chemical reaction, it increases the rate. So in fermentation, you increase the temperature, you're going to ferment faster, and you'll get that beer out of the tank quicker, but you will produce more fusel alcohols. That's the hangover alcohols. So that is what Shinobu was saying. The same thing I'm saying.
Will you also get off flavors if you
increase the
temperature?
Yeah, I mean, if you go too far... fusels are really harsh, really harsh. And in spirits, there's with a cheap distillation, they're called congeners, and they're, you know, I'm not the expert there, but they're when you have a really rough kind of, you know, distilled spirit, that's also maybe their cuts, it gets a little complicated, but it's probably like, yeah, they're just doing things faster and cheaper and taking more of the product that they should be for when people distill, the really good stuff is called the hearts. But if you're extending the hearts a little back forward and beyond for the tails and the foreshots, you're going to get a hangover. And if that's the stuff that you're putting into your fortified sake, then they're going to get a hangover.
I understand.
Your people.
So you're not, so. When if someone's making a larger production sake and they're adding this alcohol, you may not know.
Cheap alcohol. Yeah.
Yes.
So.
But Pete, just since we're talking, because it's great to see you, man.
Yes.
I know you have a kid who's over 3 years old now.
And you have a 21-year-old.
My daughter's 21, but
yeah, that's amazing.
I'm still young. But your journey of brewing, and I know we've talked about it before, but just to our new listeners who may not know,
yeah,
when did you first brew your first batch of beer?
In my kitchen.
How old are you?
How am I now?
Now, how old were you when you first brewed a batch of beer?
It must have been 36 years old, I guess.
Oh yeah,
I'm not good at math.
But you had a science background.
Yeah, yeah. I was working in a lab at the time.
You were in a movie, right?
Yeah. There's a
New York home brewer.
What is that movie called?
I don't remember, but I watched that documentary.
It was a documentary about beer in New York. And
I see your apartment, and you are doing.
We were making a beer in my apartment. Funny thing is, my assistant home brewer at the time was Al Duval, who's the head brewer for Brooklyn Brewery. And he was there stirring my mash. He's an amazing brewer. He's been brewing for maybe 30 years in New York. He's an awesome brewer.
But I think he's also a folk musician.
He is.
Have you had his banjo?
Yes. Yeah. Well, he hung up his banjo. He refuses to play it again. Yeah. In fact, he hung up one of his banjos in my apartment. And I'm like, Banjo Man Brewing. You got to start a brewery called Banjo Man Brewing. Bring back the banjo, I keep telling him. I told him that last week. But
but you start up a Pete. On that note, this is really fun and all that. There's so much we can talk about, all these things. But let's give a shout out to Al Duval. I mean,
Al Duval is a legend.
Been working in breweries in New York a long time. Shinobu, last one for you. So again, I want to go back to this health thing because I'm trying to, as our industry changes and grows, to talk about the difference. You know, there's a price point on, let's say, mass-produced alcohol, and there's a price point on smaller-produced alcohol. And I don't think the word craft has to matter. I think that it's about the size of the production and the care that's put into it. So if people are taking shortcuts on some larger production products, you know, tell us what you're doing. I want to hear about why Kato Sake. What we just drank was so good.
Really?
And
good.
The hardest part of anything, like for me as a longtime taster in 1992, I took a sommelier class. That's how I got into this. And I just went from this really soft, beautiful sake to a nice, like perky Hefeweizen from Rockaway, which now I'm digging too. However, the transition's tough.
Yeah.
You know, and when I've always been like, when I find something I like, I want to keep drinking your sake.
We drink it all.
And now I'm onto Pete's, the Rockaway Hefeweizen, I want to keep drinking that. So how do you capture your customer or not lose them? Because there's so many choices available.
That's true. Well, we are not doing great on the marketing or sales side, but maybe because we are just, you know, everybody working at our space is mostly on the craft.
Just focusing on making as much as you can.
Yeah. Right now we are not at the stage of doing something creative or fun, but we've been for the past 3-4 years, we've been doing everything on the textbook in a way that textbook is written. So our goal at this point is to make the same quality of sake consistently to the customer, to the level that, you know, we can supply to all the demands. And then we are not doing anything creative or fancy at our current space. Yeah.
I think the opposite. I think they're, as you said, subtle. Like that's it. To me, sake brewing is like lager brewing. So it kind of shrinks the playing field down from ales and lagers and everything. Like lager brewing is very subtle too, but you can really flex your
Pete,
your brewing.
Let's finish with that.
Yeah.
How is lager brewing subtle, and how do you make a good lager versus a
time
lager?
Time. So you got to take your time. You got to do it right. Cold fermentation means, as we said earlier, it's very slow. So you got to have a right proper pitch of yeast. You got to have quality ingredients. There's nothing to hide behind in a lager. Like in an IPA, there's a little room for error because the hops are showcasing themselves and kind of hiding everything behind the scenes. But lager brewing has to be done right. For the brewers, when they make a good lager, they get respect.
All right. Shinobu, what else do you drink besides your own sake?
I drink sake, beer. I drink anything. You know, I'm not a hard liquor person, so I usually drink sake, beer, wine.
And your favorite, okay, favorite sake and food pairing in New York City. Doesn't have to be a restaurant, but what we had just now, the Nigori sake. What is, you're hungry. I'm hungry now.
I'm so hungry now.
Cheeseburger. What should I? He's going to say cheeseburger.
You said cheeseburger, Pete, because you're always thinking cheeseburger.
No, but he said it.
Pete likes a thin patty cheeseburger.
That's right.
I like my own. I make a skillet with bacon fat.
Whoa.
Smash burger.
That's cheating.
You throw a little bit of onions in and sear them together. Shinobu, what would you like to pair your Nigori sake with?
I'll go with Roberta's pizza because I'm trying to bring my sake back to the Roberta's menu.
So we'll go in there. We're here now.
It would work. It would
actually
work.
I forgot we're at Roberta's Pizza. We're going to have some pizza. And then Pete, with this nice, did you make this Hefeweizen from Rockaway?
Hefeweizen.
So you are brewing at Rockaway.
Yeah.
We know you as a great brewer in New York and everyone has their journey. Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
But so this is, I love this Hefeweizen.
This Hefeweizen is like a long lost style that's suddenly coming back. Like, I know Grimm's making one. We've been making one. Brooklyn discontinued theirs, but I'll bet they'll bring it back because it was a great beer. It's a yeast-forward beer. It's yeast-driven. It's such a simple beer, but they're delicious. They're amazing. And it's like ska music. I burned out on it in the 80s, and now I'm like, I can listen to it again.
I think that I should one day tell everyone what the first beer list was at Jimmy's number 43 in 2005 because
there's probably a Hef on there.
Well, we had two pilsners, one of which was a Belgian pils because people asked for Stella, and we had two wheats. One was a Hefeweizen from Germany.
Nice.
The other was a Belgian wit.
Oh, excellent.
And then we had a other range of beers, and the IPAs might have been two lines as well, emerging American IPAs. So yeah. I want to say Hefeweizen, I can drink it, and also. Last thing about food and beer pairing, having been asked years ago, many years ago, by some food writers, what should we pair with this and wild salmon or something? And I my go-to was German Hefeweizen, or that style, is probably in general, and I can speak in blanket statements. It's generally a very food-friendly beer.
Definitely, yeah.
So once again, we had some great Nigori sake. And this Hefeweizen from Rockaway that Pete brewed. And we're going to eat some pizza at Roberta's. Hey, man, Roberta's Pizza, we still love you, and we're here. So thanks so much. Armin Spengen, our engineer. We had Shinobu and Pete. Thanks for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. It's so great being back in the studio, Roberta's Pizza. All right. Woo! Thank you.
Yeah, buddy.
All right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Whaley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.